Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Governor Tony Evers issues an executive order requiring face masks to be worn whenever someone is not in their own home, saying, "We cannot allow this virus to go unchecked," and 61 of 72 Wisconsin counties are experiencing high COVID-19 activity.
More than 25 Operation Legend agents are headed for Milwaukee, but federal and local officials said they will solve crimes and not confront any protesters. And Democratic National Convention officials order strict daily health protocols for everyone coming to the Milwaukee event. Rewind, your week in review for July 31.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
The biggest news of the week, obviously, Governor Evers yesterday ordering a statewide face mask requirement, those over five, if you're indoors or in an enclosed space. To set the table for a, J.R. and I are going to talk about this for a while, but to set the table for that, let's listen to the Governor, Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm, the governor's chief legal counsel, Ryan Nielsen-Stoon. Then it went to the Elections Commission. Let's hear a question from Dean Knutson. And finally, the wrap-up summary of the motion from Elections Commission Chair Ann Jacobs. Please.
Today, I declared a new statewide public health emergency as we battled a new surge of COVID-19 across our state. I also announced a new face covering order that will go into effect on August 1st at 12:01 a.m. Science and public health experts are telling us that face coverings and masks can save lives. My mask protects you, your mask protects me, and our masks work best when we both wear them together. This is about life and death and about making sure that we're keeping, even though we may be frustrated by it because we don't have it or we hate to have to wear a mask and it's an imposition. We're helping save lives. And I think that is an overwhelmingly substantive way to look at it.
Wisconsin is in a much more serious situation today than we were a month ago, or even when the governor declared a public health emergency in March. Between the data showing Wisconsin's community spread and the science informing us that people can spread COVID-19 without even knowing it, we need to take every action possible to protect ourselves and our communities. And this is where the science and the governor's actions today intersect.
Wearing a mask is not a hard thing to do when you're in public. I think one of the goals we did with this order is making sure that it was narrowly tailored. When you're at your private residence or at a private residence, it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply when you're outside, but when you're out and about in public, indoors or in enclosed spaces, it does apply. And, you know, taking a very simple action like wearing a mask has a really significant impact on cutting down the spread of COVID-19. So we're hoping that people make the right decision, that when there are situations where people aren't complying, that local officials try to educate first before going down the enforcement route, because again, it's a really simple thing that we can all do in order to reduce the spread of COVID-19.
And what my fear is that if we aren't very, very clear that the governor's mandate does not apply at the polling place to voters, that you're going to have voters that are harassing other individuals who are there trying to exercise their franchise.
It is unanimous 6-0. The Elections Commission unanimously recommends that all voters wear masks.
Jared, let me make about 4 points on this, and then I'm very, very interested in your reaction, and then we'll get to the reaction of the Republicans, Voss and the Senate Republicans. But just 4 points. The governor said COVID-19 has exploded, so he had to act to protect public health. Point one. The press release from the governor's office, new daily cases had averaged 938 between July 22 and 26, a two-thirds increase from the first week in July. The 60-day order covers everyone over five when indoors or in enclosed spaces, as the governor says, except in your own home. DAs have the power to enforce, but we can talk about the sheriffs that are beginning to issue press releases saying, not going to be, don't call us. And the order coincides with Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky joining the court tomorrow. That's a separate item that we'll be going to later. Okay, thanks for your patience. Your reaction to what we heard?
I guess the question is, what changed? you know, if you think about it, Governor Evers for the last couple of weeks has been telling us he would like to do a mask mandate, but he A, thought he'd get sued, and B, if he was sued, would lose. So what changed from that statement in the recent weeks to the one issued yesterday? Well, there's the court. Jill Karofsky replaces Daniel Kelly. Don't forget, we have until end of today a 5-2 conservative majority in the Supreme Court. Tomorrow it becomes 4-3. The big change, though, is that Daniel Kelly, one of the conservatives who voted to overturn state home order, comes off the court, and Jill Karofsky, liberal, goes on. That puts the emphasis on Brian Hagedorn. Remember, he's conservative, but he sided with the liberals in saying that he thought the order should have been upheld because he thought lawmakers lacked standing to file a lawsuit. So is that it? Well, we asked Evers about that Thursday, and he said that it's not Jill Karofsky, it's the virus.
Right.
But I do get the impression, talking to people, that if there is a lawsuit, Evers stands a much better chance of winning with this composition than he did before. So there's that piece. Now, the governor's saying that the virus has changed, and it's increasing. Some questions I have. The original order he issued was under a declaration of public health emergency. This is a new declaration of a public health emergency. Is this truly a separate health emergency? I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But it's the same disease, just a different dynamic. How's that going to play out in court? So there's something to watch as we see a possible lawsuit. The other thing is the political piece of this for Republicans and the legal piece of this. The legal piece is who's going to file the suit. Look what Robin Voss said right after the Evers announcement. It was that he expected citizen groups, quote unquote, to challenge this. That's important because in Hagedorn's dissent, he didn't think lawmakers had standing to file the lawsuit. It seems to be a nod saying, hey, if there's going to be a court decision or a challenge, it's going to have to come from somebody else. We can't do it this time because of what Hagedorn said before. Also, the governor's order exempts pieces of the Capitol under the authority of the legislature. So it seems to be saying that there's no impact on you lawmakers and how you do your jobs. That also is a nod for possibly going to see somebody outside of the Capitol file the suit. Well, we have the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty already saying it's looking at the case and considering legal action. So I guess what I'm watching is, what does Will do and when does it do it?
Well, okay, but you talk about what's changed. I want to use one example. I want to use the example of Iron County. I looked it up on DHS's database yesterday. Iron County now has 69 positives. And you know how they measure this? They measure the incident rates by 100,000 population. So in just a few weeks, Iron County is now 5 in terms of having the most number of cases per 100,000. And just to review, who's number one? Milwaukee. Number two, Racine. Number three, Brown. Number four, Kenosha. And now Iron County borders the UP, one of our smallest counties. So that's one of the things that's changed, JR. So it seems to me that if the governor has to defend this in court, he's going to say, look at some of these startling numbers. Any response to that before we go to the GOP?
That's what I'm getting at with that. The second, or I thought that they issued a second public health declaration. That was, I thought, interesting. And again, I don't know, not being a lawyer, I don't know how, if this is truly a second one, like how that works. But that could be because remember, on the original order, he had 60 days of authority of these special powers. By issuing the second order, he creates a new 60-day window of these special powers. That also includes, he could, in theory, issue an order shutting down schools. He can, in theory, issue an order, again, closing businesses. He didn't talk about wanting to do those things yesterday. So he spoke to the mask mandate, but he's created a new window of powers for himself in the second declaration.
Okay, but okay. JR, I didn't get, here are the questions I have. We both listened to the DHS briefing. How does the mask requirement apply to schools? My grandkids and your two boys, are they? Is your understanding they have to mask up at all times?
I did not see an exemption for schools if I read the order correctly.
I'm sorry, there is or is not?
An exception for schools in the order that I read.
Okay. Now let's go back to the Knutson and Jacobs exchange. Knutson said that he used the term franchise, which is your constitutional right to vote, and that would seem to me to trump an executive order, well, wrong term, that would seem to me to outweigh legally the governor's statewide mask order. Agree, disagree?
Nielsen, who's the governor's chief legal counsel, said in a conference call Thursday that This is not to prevent anyone from casting a ballot in the August 11th election. Now, remember, this order goes through September 28th. It only covers right now the August primary.
Yes,
and
yes.
Ryan was clear that they do not believe this is going to prevent anyone from voting. In other words, you can't be required to wear a mask in a polling site to cast your ballot because that's an unconstitutional burden on your right to vote. So they're not looking to stop that. It begs the question a little bit, especially these county sheriffs who are saying they're not going to enforce it. You know, are they trying, because there are all these exceptions for things, are they trying to send a message? Are they expecting like counties to enforce this strictly? I mean, I don't know that you're going to see rural counties go out and try and start issuing $200 citations. But for the business community, like the bank association, you know, is saying in favor of this mandate, because I wonder if the business community is saying, hey, we don't want sometimes have to police this. You know, they're stuck in this area of it's left to them because the locals aren't doing it some places. So what do they do? Then how do they police people who don't want to wear a mask, right, in their businesses? So it's an interesting situation for the private sector.
Sure it is. And I just went to the Facebook page of the Dodge County Sheriff, and let me read what the sheriff posted. We are asking that you not contact the sheriff's office when someone is not wearing a mask. Second sentence, deputies will not respond to or investigate these incidents. Okay, now let's turn to the official reactions, both of Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. The statement from Speaker Voss. Local governments have been responding appropriately. Wisconsin shouldn't have a one-size-fits-all mandate. There are certainly constitutional questions here. I would expect legal challenges from citizens groups, as you alluded to earlier. But now, JR, let's look closely at what Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said. Masks are fine, but we don't need statewide mandates. The legislature should be reconvening to look at this. The last thing our police need to be doing right now is serving as part of the mask patrol. And finally, final point, we had immediately four Republican senators, Kapinga, Strobel, Nass, and Devin LeMahieu, come out against it. And then we just got a fifth, Senator Howard Markline, excuse me for mispronouncing his name. JR, here's my question. Speaker Voss referred to legal challenges by citizen groups. Fitzgerald, the legislature should be reconvening. Why can't they agree?
Also, Dave Craig, I think he's also said he's opposed to it.
So that's number six. Thank you.
I think there are different dynamics right now in the two chambers. Think about it for a second. One, in the Senate, let's back up. Republicans are struggling in suburban areas right now, especially with President Trump. He's a drag on them in suburban areas. But look at the way the districts are drawn. Senate Republicans who represent suburban areas, they're pretty Republican seats. But if you drill down to the assembly seats in those suburban areas, people like Jim Ott, Menominee Falls, Rob Hutton, and Brookfield, they have much tougher races this fall than most state senators. So I get the impression that in the Senate Republican caucus right now, there's much more of a call to action, right, among Republicans than the assembly, where it's a little bit different split because there's different dynamics. You have some people who want to do something right away. You have some who are like, let's just leave this alone, wait for a lawsuit, and some looking for guidance from leadership. I think they've got a little bit trickier situation. And oh, by the way, if Republicans come in and overturn the mandate and there's a spike in cases or something happens and then Eva says, look, I got to close schools because you guys turn off this mask mandate, who gets blamed for that? And I think Republicans are in a tough situation always because the people who don't like masks really, really, really don't like them.
Right.
I think there are a couple of lawmakers told me that they've had a lot of contacts from us already, and from this very passionate crowd saying, this is an infringement on my rights. I don't like these things. But if you look at, I haven't seen good polling on it. I saw one poll in June, I think, from Will. I think 68% of people in that survey supported requiring masks in public. Now, we haven't seen anything in the Marquette poll yet. I'm hoping to see that in the new poll out later this month. But I don't know where people are right now, really, as a society in Wisconsin on a mandate like this.
Okay, we've got other subjects, but I just want to add one more point to this. I went back to the Supreme Court Safer at Home, the Supreme Court order striking down Safer at Home, and there's this very curious line. This case is not about Governor Tony Evers' emergency order or the powers of the governor. So remember, they struck down having the Secretary of Health Services issue a order without the rulemaking process. I just find that statement just very interesting. Any PSs before we move on?
No, I mean, I'm just waiting to see who files a lawsuit, what court it's going to be in. I assume one's coming.
Yep. Okay.
It's going to be.
Okay. We spent a lot of time on that, so we got to move on. Let's just quickly note that Jill Karofsky is going to literally run into office tomorrow. She's going to, she said in a statement, you know, I'd like to have a big party and a big swearing in, but we can't because of COVID. So I'm going to run 100 miles. She's an Uber marathoner, and at the 35-mile point, she's going to stop and be sworn in. She beat Justice Dan Kelly. This narrows the conservative bloc, as you alluded to, from 4-3. And just a PS, JR, the next scheduled Supreme Court election, the seat of Chief Justice Rogan's Act, not until 2023. Any PSs before we move on?
Karofsky is going to begin her run Saturday morning at 6 a.m. and finish at noon on Sunday.
Wow.
Just to put that in perspective, and two, that race in 2023, it will be for control of the court. It will break spending records. Anything we've seen so far, the $10 million spent this past spring will be left in the dust by that race in 2023, barring something crazy happening.
Yeah, but I want to put emphasis on the 2023. A lot can happen by then. Okay, new topic. Operation Legend, Legend Agents are coming to Milwaukee. The U.S. Attorney Matthew Krieger, 25 to 30 agents, won't respond to protests, but will focus on violent crime. Murder rates that are 85% higher, homicide rates in the city of Milwaukee than same period last year. Also, the U.S. Department of Justice announced Milwaukee, Tulsa, Cudahy police departments will get $12 million to hire new officers, fight crime. Local, state, and elected officials, you saw all these press releases. Don't repeat Portland and Seattle when these legend agents come. And then finally, JR, the statement from Milwaukee Mayor Barrett, that's going to allow us to deal with issues like sex trafficking, like violent crime, gun crime. We're going to look at this and make sure you are not using these federal officials to make us another Portland. Realistically, these agents are not going to be standing outside Milwaukee's federal building if there are protests.
Attorney assured people in the news conference this week you will not see federal agents amassing in the streets of Milwaukee as part of this initiative. Now, Democrats were on the defensive right away because of what they saw in Portland. And the U.S. attorney and the FBI agent in charge of this announcement went out of their way to assure people this is not about that. It's about violent crime. They also announced the increase of a reward in the, for the shooting death of a 16-year-old girl in Milwaukee. So they really took pains to try and say this is not about Portland. At the same time, you know, the president wants to be seen as somebody who's going into these democratically run cities and saying, I'm here to stop crime. So there's a little distrust going on, but let's see how it plays out, especially what happens at the convention, if you can see a change in tone in the next month.
Thank you for a wonderful segue, because our next topic is the new emerging rules for the Democratic National Convention. Let me say what's left of it, 2 hours per night, convening in Milwaukee, August 17th. If you're a delegate, media, law officer, here's what you have to do. You have to wear face masks unless you're speaking to the convention. You have to consent to daily testing for COVID-19. You have to complete questionnaires on personal health, what daily contacts you had, and of course, you have to social distance. I was intrigued. Wasn't it 6-7 months ago that this was 50,000 people were coming and the economic impact, 200 million. But now, listen to the advice. Going to the DNC, visitors should also avoid bars, restaurants where social distancing is not possible or not practiced. Finally, you have a number of dozens. I read one headline, more than 100 police departments are withdrawing from their pact of mutual aid, saying the limits imposed, no pepper spray, no tear gas, raise questions about whether we want our officers to help protect those attending the DNC in the face of any protests. What do you think, JR? The incredible shrinking DNC.
Well, it's always been about delivering a message. That's all conventions are anymore, is a staged message of, you know, kind of pumping up your nominee, this build up from Monday through Thursday of, you know, announcing him or her as the chosen one, right? They're still going to have that message. It's going to be a different way. It's not going to have the big dramatic roll call in front of thousands of people in the arena. It's going to be much different. But same time, I mean, this is the reality of what we're dealing with right now with COVID-19. So I don't know how much it changes the message piece of it. Also, what are the protests are going to look like? Are there going to be any signs of disunity, for example, the Democrats? Because there's still like this Sanders, Biden kind of like tiff about certainly the platform, how will that play out? Might there be less coverage of those kinds of things because they're not there in person? Possibly. They still have like day-long kind of like online caucus and meetings, but I don't know that who's going to watch those or tune in, you know, and cover them in depth.
And didn't Senator Tammy Baldwin was at one of your luncheons with a press club say she would support a do-over for Milwaukee getting the DNC in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. You know, the tipping points in the presidential elections are changing all the time. Like, Arizona might be the next swing state, the true swing state. Like, we started out the cycle as the kind of key swing state, but 4 years is a long time. So I don't know if we're still going to be that important compared to an Arizona. We'll see, especially after the census and electoral votes get shifted around a little bit. We might not be as important 4 years from now.
Yeah. Okay. New topic. One thing that you guys do at WIS Politics is you really keep track of the money. You reported these six numbers, and then I'm going to give you a chance to talk about any other fundraising. So let's just look at the six candidates in tough races who raised more than $100,000 the first 6 months of this year. And excuse me, there was a pandemic for most of it, which money should maybe not have come that easily. But anyway, Dan Kampanke fighting to come back to the Republican, fighting to come back to the Senate from La Crosse, $187,000. One Democrat running against him, the highest profile Democrat running against him since he was the Fire Department of Ag Secretary, Brad Pfaff, $155,000. Steve Doyle, also in the La Crosse area, targeted by the Republicans, $132,000. Representative Beth Myers, a Democrat from northern Wisconsin, $117,000. Paul Piotrowski, a retired police officer running against Republican Senator Teston, $110,000. And Democratic Representative Robin Weinig, who won a seat that had been controlled by Republicans 2 years ago, $101,000. JR, what else do we need to know? Because I've been reading your numbers, and there's just been a lot of other fundraising. So can you walk us through that?
Well, one of the most important things that I saw in all these reports was the Democratic Party's numbers, right? The $10 million raised in the second quarter. And why I bring that up is because that money is going to flow from the party to the legislative campaign committees and into the coffers of candidates. Why is that important? Because, for example, the caucuses, right? So the Senate Democrats, the Assembly Democrats, Senate Republicans all have their own campaign committees. Money flows to power in politics, the way it works. So Republican campaign committees have raised more the last 10 years because they control the legislature. Well, the Senate Democrats this past six-month period were just off from the Senate Republicans by about like $4,000, all right? That's significant when you think about it. And in part, why they're so close is because the state Democratic Party gave them a six-figure contribution. The more successful Ben Wickler is with the state party raising money, the more he can help those campaign committees, those caucuses, the more those guys can help the key races where they're trying to prevent a two-thirds majority in both houses for Republicans. It also may help Democrats go on the offensive in some places that maybe they couldn't before. 2 years ago, we did not see this kind of money flowing into Democratic campaign committees at this point. The party is what's changed. And like somebody told me, look, they raised that much money in this 3 months. This is just the buildup. The real show is beginning now, yeah. Right? The next 4 months. What can they raise this 3 month period? It's just something to keep an eye on, that it might level the playing field somewhat in Wisconsin for Democrats at the legislative level.
And the context here, we've said it before, we have to say it again. The backdrop here is the Republican goal for a veto-proof ledge, right?
And that's all about the maps. Remember, we expect right now, unless Republicans get two-thirds majorities, we expect Republicans to try to pass a map sometime in 2021 based off the new census material. Governor Evers will veto it. We go to court. Now, they may say, the heck with it, just go to court, and I'm about passing a plan. If Republicans get to two-thirds majorities, they can pass a map, Evers vetoes it, they override it, and you have locked in good lines again for 10 years for Republicans. So that's what I'm watching. You know, that's what it's all about, really, for legislative level, is that two-thirds majority about those maps.
Okay, final topic of this show, JR. There are still many people in Wisconsin, I'll give you the latest number in a minute, who are still waiting to get their unemployment benefits. So let's walk through that. It's very important. Often when I interview candidates for the ledge, they mention it, depending on whether you're a DNR. Anyway, this week, the Department of Workforce Development said it had removed 40,000 claims of those who had filed but didn't follow up the required weekly paperwork. Removing those claims, and this is the new number, left 97,939 claims pending. Translation, those are people, most of whom are entitled to benefits, but because of old software, and they may have been denied, it's still pending. But the backdrop here is since March 15, DWD received applications for 4.9 million weeks of U of I benefits, smashing all records three or four times last year's claims. But interesting now, I just found this interesting wrinkle. U.S. Senate Republicans are talking about $1,200 per person, yes, but when you get into the debate of should we continue the $600 per week, many Republicans say, no, it's a disincentive. You're discouraging people from work. So let's talk about $200, or let's talk about 70% of the average worker's salary. Now, Ben Jed, spokesman for DWD, raised all kinds of flags saying, while DWD supports providing supplemental unemployment benefits, any change to benefits that is not a flat rate, in other words, not an additional flat $600, would take substantial programming that could delay the distribution of payments. Translation, my translation, JR, don't make us compute 70% of average, because we already are operating with a computer system from 1985. Don't make us do this. Is that your takeaway too?
Now, if you look at the Senate GOP proposal, there's revisions that are trying to give states flexibility of either doing a flat rate or doing the fixed percentage of somebody's wages, also some flexibility to have time to transition to this. But we're already at a backlog. And the point DBE is making is we're already at a backlog. If you add this, it's more difficult because as what Ben told me was they've already written a program for a flat add-on. Reworking the numbers from 600 to whatever is not as difficult as creating a whole new program that calculates that fixed percentage going forward. That would be the slowdown. Now, with this Senate GOP proposal, which who knows where it's going to end up when they're all said and done, would there be enough time under this flexibility for the state to put it in place? Maybe. Could the state be creative and have enough of an idea that would pass muster with the Trump administration? Maybe. But right now, we don't even know if they're going to pass any kind of an add-on. It seems like there's momentum for doing something, but what it looks like is up in the air. That even though it expires today, it actually, Wisconsinites, expired this past week because we do our weeks end on Sundays.
Right, right.
So your last full week of $600, if you're unemployed right now, was this past Sunday. This week, you're back to just getting the state money.
Right, right.
Now, if the feds approve something else, they'll be back paying that kind of stuff. But this is like basically your classic Washington, D.C. standoff, a game of chicken, of what can I get out of this deal in this negotiation.
Right, and let's point out that the U.S. House passed a $3 trillion with a T package, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell came out with $1 trillion with a T package. They're a long way apart. Okay, JR, we got about a minute left. I just want to ask you, why was it news that former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish formed a PAC this week? Go.
Because she's going to run for governor in 2022. So she's basically starting to build up those, we call them chips in politics. You know, you curry favor over the years. And I'm going to bet you is that I'm going to look at the list of people she gives money to running for legislature this fall. Then look at her initial campaign endorsement rollouts. I'm going to see a lot of common names between those two lists. She's basically trying to build up her campaign operation, her supporters, and she's going to have sometime in 2021 is my guess, she's going to announce she's running for governor, and you're going to see some of these folks she supported this fall come out there and help her out. She helped recruit 25, I think, candidates for legislature this fall, assembly this fall, so okay. She is doing the nitty-gritty, that the foundation work for run for governor.
Okay. Okay, we only got a few seconds. Let's talk about next week's rewind. We're going to look at the number of absentee ballots that have been sought and that have been turned in. We're going to preview there are 8 incumbents that are being challenged, Ron Kind, all the way down to 7 or 8 members of the ledge, JR. Okay, we're going to look at those. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm JR Ross.
That's Rewind for July 31.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association. bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.